Spark Media presents Cosmic Creatures by Jason Kent Nord. Performed for you by Adam Anagnostou, Mike Kelly, John Yonker, and Luke Langfeld. Sound design by Dan Steffens. This episode contains content that may be alarming to some listeners. Please check the episode notes for more detailed descriptions. And now, Episode 10, Velocity.
I'm weirdly proud of myself for three reasons. First off, I busted my ass to save those two kids, and aside from that bully's crushed junk, things turned out pretty well. Hell, it served the kid right. He'll probably end up fine anyway, the way things seem to go. But if not, society doesn't need his offspring anyway. Yep. For once, I was a goddamn hero and not a complete fuck-up. Second, I did not head straight to the bar. Nope. I made a beeline here to the liquor store. Immediately recognizing how absurd that sounds prompts a laugh and a corresponding jolt to my ribs. I ride out the sting with an amused groan. No, obviously I didn't come here for booze. That's what I'm proud about. I came to this gravel lot off the back corner of the liquor store to collect my thoughts and reconsider what's my best course of action. I'm not rushing to escape my problems. I'm here to face them. And third, my collected thoughts have been consumed with Kale's well-being, not my own. It's reshuffled my evaluation of what's best for him. I still think he deserves better than me. I'm just flat out not the best father. And I'm not stupid enough to think that going back to him automatically fixes anything. But his safety right now means more than I ever could have imagined, and I've made a decision. I'm going to go check on him. It's the parental bond. I might suck at being one, but my heart's never been in the wrong place. Just in the wrong condition without Maria. Yeah, I have to go make sure Kale is at least okay. And hopefully I can find out covertly. When it looks like he's safe, I'll figure out things from there. Seeing those kids, the little boy on his tricycle being preyed upon by those freaky bird creatures, and then those punks and that tree walker. And then discovering that Kale wasn't in school, realizing he might have been at the center of this disaster. I shudder to think that he might be in serious trouble. I stare at the pair of commercial garbage dumpsters hiding out with me behind the liquor store, nearly overflowing with garbage, but I don't really see them. I'm weighing my options for how to get past that military checkpoint blocking my way home. The road out of town snakes around a nasty ravine that makes a direct overland shortcut impossible. It's too steep and rocky. Trying to sneak through that ravine would only be possible in rare spots, and hunting for them in my condition doesn't appeal to me at all. Besides, even if I did find a spot to cross, I'd end up on the same road, which they are likely patrolling. No, the only option is to try to cross near the checkpoint where the ravine isn't so bad. My best bet is to follow the road to my least favorite spot, the billboard. Any further and they might spot my headlights. But once there, I can park the van and go down to the edge of the ravine and follow it to a crossable spot. I should be able to stay hidden in the darkness and climb up to the road on the other side without getting too close to the checkpoint. Then, I just need to cross the road unnoticed and head toward home. It'll be a 6-mile walk from there, but there's no other option as far as I can tell. Attempting to get the van through the checkpoint would be a good way to get shot. A barking dog breaks my train of thought. In the patch of the front paved lot, visible from my location at the rear of the store, I see its shadow. It's outlined by the neon glow of the liquor store's sign, but it's gone in a blink as it retreats toward the front entrance. Then another strange shadow appears. What the? It's not another dog, nor a person. I don't think. You know, I can't be sure of what I'm seeing. Something scurries a few feet and then bounces out of sight, seeming to emit a dim yellow light. My window is cracked open, and I swear I hear a sharp yelp. Did I imagine that? Normally, I'd chalk it up to the alcohol messing with my senses, but I'm unnervingly sober. Could it have been another one of those creatures? I swear it looked like a miniature gorilla, but it didn't move like one. I'm relieved to be in the safety of the van. Coming face to face with a flying gorilla is the stuff of a horror movie remake of The Wizard of Oz. No, thank you. Suddenly, the mission I'm contemplating doesn't seem like such a good idea. But if Kale is out there, it's just that much more crucial that I go. I have to at least check on him. If he's fine, then I'll leave. But if he needs me, I will do whatever it takes to protect him. That's for goddamn sure. I'll just have a lot of explaining to do. The lights on the liquor store go out. I check the time on the dash. Looks like that crotchety bastard is closing 15 minutes early again. I don't know the guy's name, but Kale nicknamed him Gus a while back. It fits. Kind of short for grumpy ass. I long ago came to understand that I had to treat his posted closing time as unreliable. Always closing earlier, never later. But maybe Gus saw the dog, or knows about that thing out front? The last thing I want is to play rescuer again, but maybe I should move to where I can see if the guy is going to make it to his truck. Something about this just isn't sitting right in my gut. I hold tight, reconsidering. If he hears the van and sees me, he might call the sheriff if he's heard about me abandoning Kale. It's a small town and word gets around. Ah, screw it. He won't recognize me. Not in this vehicle, with as dark as it is. And hopefully I won't be around to ever shop here again. If Kale's all right with the Hagens and I manage to get away from here, then I sure hope I find a liquor store where I'm treated with, well, any respect. I start the van, handling it with delicate care, hoping it'll idle quietly. Thankfully, it cooperates, emitting only the faintest hum. I ease it into gear and idle forward, applying minimal pressure on the gas pedal. The brakes have been a little noisy, so I crawl forward, trying to avoid any squeaks that would draw attention. As my view of the front lot expands, I spot the tailgate of his lone vehicle, its lights still dark. I ease to a stop, just poking out by the side of the building. Gus walks over to his tailgate and to what appears to be an animal's body lying just beside it. He hunches over it, not that his beer gut allows much of a crouch. It's that dog, and it's dead. That other thing must have killed it. Then, before I can even react, I notice it, a yellow glow flickering in and out from the shadows, revealing a diminutive, hunchbacked creature fixated on the man. Gus is unaware, and in fact, he glances my way, spotting me just as the creature leaps. "Look out!" I shout through the partially rolled-down window. It's too late! The vicious creature descends upon the man's shoulder. The struggle is brief. He's on his back, defenseless, as the creature inflicts fatal wounds to his face, neck, and chest. I stomp the gas, gravel flying as I race past the scene and out onto the road. Passing by, I impulsively look to see if the dying bloke has a final expression to share with me. He does not, and his gaze is wrenched up to the heavens. The beast, though, does have eyes for me. The menacing glare sends a shiver down my spine, and I defensively look away, focusing on the road and gaining distance. Accelerating down Route 5, I intently inspect my mirrors for any sign that it might be in pursuit. Thankfully, it remains half-bent over Gus's body, sticking with its meal. I shudder and continue to speed away, catching a fading roar from the beast. Dear God, help us all.
As soon as I see the sign, I begin to lose my newfound confidence. A no trespassing sign with government markings is rudely glued next to the front screen door on the doorframe's chipped paint. I'm officially no longer welcome in the only home I've ever known. I take a step back and blink a few times, letting it sink in. Lost my mother, my father, now my home. I want to ignore it. I want to understand that it's just bureaucracy in motion, but that doesn't stop the punch to my gut. And I can't help but wonder what Dad would think if he saw it too. I guess this is what he meant in the letter, the bank taking the house. He probably couldn't handle this and all its implications. Pity, anger, fear, and loneliness wrestle my heart into a knot. It's still no reason to ditch your own kid. I'm not disposable. You don't get to just bail on parenting. He should have loved me too much for it to even be a thought. I inhale deeply, then exhale slowly, attempting to steady myself. I understand he had issues with depression and alcohol, and even though I know better on some level, it's hard to shake the feeling that the universe has branded me as unworthy of love. A hand touches my shoulder. It's Ellie's. I catch her reassuring expression, but look away, barely giving a nod. I can't fall through an emotional trapdoor right now. I can't. I open the screen door and reach for the handle, only to find a lockbox hanging from a new doorknob. I nearly slam the screen door in frustration. Crap. They changed her locks, Nick groans. That's brutal, man, Fitch starts. Do you think... It's fine, Ellie interjects, seemingly sensitive to my feelings and trying to redirect. We can figure something else out. But we need decent weapons, Nick laments. Dude, if they locked it up, they didn't leave any in there, Fitch snarks. Maybe they didn't get that far and just locked it up, Nick retorts. Guys, Ellie snaps. Let's just go back... My window, I interrupt. My bedroom window has a latch that's been broken for years. I lead the way as we file around to the side of my house. It's weird, though. It doesn't feel like it's mine anymore. It feels abandoned and somewhat creepy. I still feel attached to the place, but it's like that's wrong now. A wooden pallet leans against the side of the house, concealed behind a juniper bush. I lift it, drag it over into a spot under my window. It's not the first time I've done this. Whenever I came home and sensed that Dad might have had too much to drink, I'd prefer this option to strolling through the front door and into his sphere of turmoil. While he never once turned violent towards me, he'd go off on a tirade against the world, rant about me not spending more time with him, or dive into some other self-loathing episode. None of them were fun to be a part of. I climb the slats, steady myself, and try the window. It doesn't even budge. Damn it. They secured it, I growl as I hop down. So, they probably took the guns too, Fitch reiterates. Well, not necessarily, I muse. He kept them under the floor of his closet. It lifts up and you have to move a loose baseboard to find the finger holds. It was pretty cool how Dad rigged it, actually. I remember wondering for years what Dad was doing whenever I'd spot him on his hands and knees, fussing in his small bedroom closet. He'd always yell at me to get out before I could see. Then, about 2 years ago, a guy Dad owed some money to showed up when I was home alone. He barged in, tore the place up, and interrogated me, demanding to know where Dad was and where he kept his money. When I said I didn't know, he grabbed me by the arms, shouted in my face, and threw me to the floor. It was terrifying. Dad returned home later that night, beaten up. The next day, he showed me the hidden space under the floorboards and how to access it. He showed me his firearms, a rifle, shotgun, and 3 handguns. Taught me how to use one of the handguns. He said if that guy ever returned, I was to retrieve the handgun and defend myself. It had scared the crap out of me. But it was also the first time Dad had really opened up and treated me like a man, even though I was only 12. You know, typical father-son bonding moments. Not fishing trips or sporting events for us, no. Just drunken outbursts and seedy debt collectors. Ellie and Nick are drifting toward the back of the house, Nick mentioning something about the back door. I turn to look for Fitch, and I'm confused by the fact that he's picking up a rock the size of a softball. As he begins his motion, I ask, "Dude, what are you..." Glass remnants of my bedroom window cascade down the side of the house and pallet. Ellie and Nick roll around, their incredulous expressions matching mine. "What?" Fitch deflects with a shrug. "Do we want to get in or not?" "You're going to attract every creature in the neighborhood," scolds Ellie. "Well, what's done is done," Nick relents. "You're welcome," Fitch says with an air of satisfaction, directed toward Ellie. I cautiously grab the pallet and lean it away from the house to let the glass fall to the ground and set it back against the wall. Carefully, I climb up to my shattered window. The shards of glass remaining around the window are foreboding, but I slowly reach through, finding the new latch with my right hand and unlatch it. Slowly withdrawing my arm, I then raise the window. Broken glass litters the sill. "Here," Ellie says, handing me a sprig she's taken from the juniper bush. "Thanks," I whisper, admiring her astute thinking. I take the sprig from her and use it to brush away most of the glass. It's good enough to avoid getting cuts while crawling through, which I carefully proceed to do. Inside, I turn to tell them I'll unlock the back door. But then I see them in the distance. Emerging straight out of an Edgar Allan Poe tale turned sci-fi horror flick, a group of otherworldly ravens descend and take perch on the scraggly tree opposite my window. Their dim purple glow casts an eerie light. Takes me a moment to recognize that they are the same creatures we saw back in the capture bay. Each of their three peculiar legs, shrouded in feathers, boasts a menacing claw. Lacking much of a tail, they occasionally extend a leg backward for balance. Their beaks are serrated with vicious incisors. Their piercing gazes send shivers down my spine. There should be eight, and that looks about right, but I'm too entranced to count. Below me on the lawn, the others are confused.
"Dude, go unlock the door!"
Fitch shouts. "What's wrong?" Nick asks, starting to look concerned. Out of my periphery, I see him turn to follow my gaze, as do Ellie and Fitch. Fitch quickly whimpers.
"Oh no, no, no."
"Back door!" I holler, snapping out of it. I turn and bolt through the house, noticing even in my hurry that the belongings I hadn't brought to the Hagginses remain in place. As I reach the kitchen and approach the back door, I'm alarmed to see that a 2x4 has been nailed across the doorway. Outside, I can hear the commotion of squawking, a shriek from Ellie, and Fitch's panicked cries. The doorknob is jiggled hard from the outside. I unlock it, and Nick wastes no time trying to open it, only to be stopped by the board.
"Kale!"
Nick shouts.
"They braced it!"
I yell.
"Hold on!"
I look around wildly for something to use to dislodge the board. The first thing I spot is the large spatula Dad uses for grilling. I grab it and plunge it into the crack between the board and the door. It might just work. I crank down on it. The end of the spatula bends, and the nails in the board give slightly, but not significantly. Outside, Fitch and Ellie's screams are growing louder. Bodies are being thrust against the door. The squawking grows in volume and seems to be circling closer and closer.
"Hurry!"
shouts Ellie.
"Come on, get it open!"
pleads Fitch. I heave hard on the spatula, begging for it not to snap. I feel the nails moving through the wood for a good half inch. The door presses that extra distance.
"Push!"
I yell, giving up on the now bent and worthless spatula to grab the knob and pull. I put a foot against the wall as a brace and pull with my entire body weight as I feel them pushing against the door. Ellie screams from an apparent attack just as the plank pops loose at one end, and the door bursts open. The trio tumbles through, sprawling under the floor. In a blizzard of flapping and squawking, a stream of ravens invade, filling the room with chaos. Needing a weapon immediately, my hand reaches for the counter before I even assess what's there. The frying pan on the stove is a welcome find. I snatch up the heavy skillet and immediately begin swatting as the first creature comes at me. My victim crashes to the floor. Before I can appreciate the success, two more descend upon me. I swing recklessly, able to keep them dodging but unable to inflict another direct hit. I sense in my peripheral vision that Ellie is scurrying along the floor into the living room with an attacker or two after her. The baseball bat doesn't seem to be helping her much, and she's intent on fleeing. Ow! One of the birds gashes my arm, refocusing me on my own defense. Before I can, I take a hit on the shin from a trash bin, which Nick has commandeered as a shield. Get it off! Get it off! Cries Fitch. He lies on the floor a few feet away with an attacker grasping his arm. I manage to land a decent strike on one of my attacker's beaks, sending it spiraling onto the counter, while the other circles the room. This gives me a chance to see Nick dive across the floor, using the trash bin as a scoop to sweep up Fitch's assailant. He then slams the bin upside down on the floor, trapping the creature. Two more ravens descend upon me. I spin, swing, and scatter my attackers. You two get out and shut the door! I yell at Nick, planning as I speak. I'll get Ellie and meet you at my window. We'll trap them in here. It's not about playing the capture versus kill angle anymore. It's survival at this point. I dodge the onslaught of the two birds and bolt toward the living room, aware enough to notice that Fitch has wasted no time getting out of the door. In the living room, I turn back, expecting to see the ravens giving chase. Instead, I see Nick swing a chair, knocking two of them away before he skitters out the door and slams it. Thankfully, the pair of creatures waste their efforts squawking and clattering at the door, the one under the trash bin still struggling in the trap. My first smash seems to have incapacitated that raven, and the one on the counter is stunned, though not defeated. The sixth kitchen dweller is now focused on me. It swoops in and dodges my swing. I yelp as a talon scrapes my arm. It leaves a decent gash, but I have to rally because it's coming back. I land a heavy, solid hit that takes it out. I swirl and shift my attention to Ellie. There are two angry purple glows flittering all around her as she lies at the base of the couch. She whips her bat about, but the narrow barrel can't land solid strikes. With an angry, frustrated swing, Ellie clips one that whizzes by my head. In doing so, Ellie loses her grip and the bat clatters away, clipping me in the knee. The other raven descends on Ellie, and she immediately grabs a couch cushion for a shield. Her attacker is rejoined by the other raven. Ellie lets out a shriek as I line up a big swing, targeting both creatures. I decimate one and send the other flying into the drapes. Fully aware that the kitten creatures will be on us at any moment, I flip Ellie's cushion aside and grab her upper arm with a surge of adrenaline. My bedroom, I command. Our brief moment of relief expires as three ravens enter the room. Spotting the couch blanket, I quickly embrace an impromptu plan. I give Ellie a nudge in the right direction and then launch the frying pan at the fluttering trio, clipping one raven and scattering the other two. I snatch up the blanket and hold it draped down in front of me, as I retreat backward down the hallway. The two active assailants rush me, and I raise the blanket in time to catch them. It costs me a sharp stab in the chest, but I succeed in dumping the blanket to the ground with them caught up in it. I dash toward Ellie and direct her into my room. As the final attacker swoops into the hallway, I grab the door and close it shut, just in time for the door slam to be echoed by the heavy thud of the angry raven. Still in flight mode, I catch hold of Ellie, clenching her forearms as she does mine. We back away from the door. Are you okay? I ask, locking eyes with her. The fear lingers in her eyes for a moment, as it must in mine. Ellie nods and her eyes soften. The moment lingers as the adrenaline begins to flush and we decompress. Then she looks down, noticing our grasp. Embarrassed, I let go and feel a blush fill my cheeks. She gives me a wry smile. Come on, she says. Back to her charming self. Let's get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Having lost the security of the van, I feel a tremendous sense of urgency as I make my way on foot very near the checkpoint. Back at the billboard, I had considered sending the van into the same dark, watery grave that holds my pickup. But I figured it was unnecessary and that I can at least let the owner get his van back. I'm on edge. I don't want that thing that got Gus catching up with me. But I also don't want to risk being spotted by any of the soldiers. So urgency and caution are battling within. I navigate my way down through the edge of the ravine well enough, but my heart speeds up when I hear voices. They are close enough that I can pick up bits of conversation. "We're going to keep him here all night or let him into town?" a soldier asks. I don't wait to hear the answer. I keep making my way south along the road, keeping my profile up against the side of the ditch. It's steep enough that most of my weight stays on my feet, but I'd stick out if I didn't also lean into the ground and rely on my hands and knees at times to help keep me moving and concealed. I'd go faster if my ribs would let me. After another 50 feet, I wonder if I'm clear of the checkpoint. The road seems to be lit with floodlights at wide intervals, casting dark shadows of the ravine walls down into the ditch. I reach the darkest spot between two far-set lights and stop to listen. After 30 seconds or so of silence, I'm ready to risk taking a peek. I start to rise, but a noise makes me halt. Boots on pavement. A soldier patrolling on foot stops above me. I hold my breath and freeze. Moments later, I hear the boots head southward again. This may be my chance. He's walking away from me. I raise my head, but the top of his head moves out of sight. I need to crawl up the embankment to get a better look. As quietly as I can, I place one hand and one foot in front of the other. Soon, I'm crouched off the edge of the road. He's still walking away, but there is another soldier about 100 feet past him walking in my direction. I glance back to the north. There are no soldiers between me and the checkpoint. I turn back to the patrols. Finally, the farther soldier turns and goes back the other direction. The guy nearest me hasn't turned back yet, but he likely will at any moment. I've got to go now. I rise and dart into the road as quickly as possible. The plan is to jump into the shallower ditch across the road and lie flat until the closer guy completes another loop and gets far enough away that he won't hear me sneak into the woods. If I tried to make a mad dash, they would hear and possibly open fire. I'm not quite ready to die just yet. I'm nearly ready to launch into the far ditch when I spot it. The ditch is lined with razor wire. I abort before takeoff, but my left foot slides on loose dirt, and I painfully wipe out. "Over here!" I hear a soldier yell. I instantly raise my hands. "Don't shoot!" I yell. Soon, the beam of a very powerful flashlight is trained on me, as is the barrel of the rifle of the sprinting soldier. "Don't shoot!" I repeat.
We hope you've enjoyed Cosmic Creatures, a Spark Media production. This program was directed and executive produced by H.G. Zeisler, featuring the voice talents of Adam Anagnostou as Cale Rhodes, Mike Kelly as Russell Rhodes, John Yonker as Dr. Elliot Hagen, and Luke Langfelt as Major Roggy. Text copyright 2022 by Jason Kent Nord. Illustrations including cover and episode art by Meredith Tuvey. Sound design by Dan Steffens. Story edits by Emily Nord and H.G. Zeisler. A special thanks to our founding Spark storytellers. Rest assured that no animals, cosmic or earthly, were harmed in the production of this episode. Enjoyed what you heard? Check out more Spark stories and find out more about Spark Media on our website, sparkmedia.com. That's sparkmedia.com. Or check us out on Instagram or Facebook at Spark Media. Links in episode notes. Interested in telling stories? Apply to be a Spark storyteller today. We're looking for writers, editors, composers, voice talent, and more. It takes a village to tell a story, and we need you. Link in episode notes. Audio production copyright 2024 by Spark Media LLC, all rights reserved.